Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 111 of Toe on the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. It is Pitching Talk with David Cone, with James Smythe, with myself, Justin Shackle. We have our wonderful producer, Dan Work, with us as well, who's going to be playing a big role in the Yankees chat coming down this episode. We'll get to that, though, a little bit later on. Guys, the Phillies are up 2-0 in the NLCS. The Rangers are up 2-0 in the ALCS. Not only that, but both series are feeling pretty lopsided at the time we're recording these here. Are these series over? What do you think, gentlemen?
Well, this is really illustrates the difference between a five-game series and a seven-game series. So with seven games, it is clearly not over. You can turn it around with one win. You know, I was in that situation in 1996. You know, you Yankee fans who remember the start of the run in 1996, we were down 2-0. We lost the first two games to the Braves at Yankee Stadium. We were completely dominated by them. It was almost as if we didn't belong in the World Series. We were outclassed. 1-9 pitching staff. They had Maddox. They had Smoltz. They had Glavine. They had three Hall of Famers. Andrew Jones was 19 years old. He took Pettitte deep a couple of times. His first World Series game there at Yankee Stadium. So, yeah, I've been there, done that. I can tell you from experience that it's not over. All it does take is one win. You need something to rally around, you know, for us, you know, and it could sort of, you know, we heard recently about clubhouse banter, you know, Bryce Harper, it got back to him, you know, attaboy Harper, the thing that was said by Arcia in the clubhouse somehow got to the opposing team. Let me tell you something. Nothing is ever in the clubhouse, stays in the clubhouse. It gets out. Clubhouse personnel, clubbies, reporters, it could be anybody who hears something, it's eventually going to get back to you. And that's what happened in 1996. The Braves were whooping it up in their visitors clubhouse, talking about their place in history and what they were going to do in this series. And it got back to us and we used it. We used it as bulletin board material. Now, what impact that really has, I don't know. It's all emotional. It's human element, but it certainly did. It pumped us up. You know, it made us sort of remind ourselves of pride. You're playing for pride here. These guys are embarrassing us. We're just a prop in the World Series here in 1996. And we used that to our advantage. I was the starting pitcher in game three. Wasn't a pretty game. I just kind of grinded out six innings, didn't give in, pitched around the edges, didn't have great stuff, but had good enough stuff to get through it. And then we ended up winning that game. And right then and there, the series turned on one win on the road in Atlanta in game three.
So you're saying this is a chronic thing for the Braves, Coney?
I'm just saying, you know, the excuse of, hey, we said it in our clubhouse, it shouldn't get out. No, it always gets out. Believe me, nothing is sacred. if you think you're saying something out loud in a clubhouse that only your teammates are going to hear it, then you're pretty naive at this point because somebody's going to hear it. As I said before, there's too many people in and out of a major league clubhouse, whether it's visiting side clubbies who talk to the home side clubbies, who eventually tell the stories and it gets back to the players. It always happens. So you don't think that just because you screamed attaboy Harper in your clubhouse that somebody overheard it and it shouldn't have been relayed. Yeah, that's wishful thinking. It always gets relayed.
Especially during the open clubhouse, open media portion of the yes. Clubhouse proceedings. But these series are far from over, especially the ALCS. Even when the Astros were further back in the division race during the season, they are the team to beat. They are the defending champs. They've been in the ALCS 7 years in a row now. Until someone beats them four times, they are the team to beat. I think that even though they lose at home and they're coming to Texas now down 2-0, I think they still have a better shot to get back in the series than Arizona. And NLCS seemed like a bit more of a mismatch to me with the Phillies and D-backs, and the Phillies really bring the hammer. Coney, you always talk about the home run differential. Well, the Phillies are bashing dingers left and right, setting records, consecutive games with three homers, most homers in a four-game span in a postseason. The Phillies, from the word go, right from Kyle Schwarber setting the tone in the leadoff spot, they can do damage. And the Phillies, I think, are in the best spot in the LCS, even though Texas has been really impressive beating the Astros twice.
Yeah, I'm with you, James. I think the ALCS is far from over, probably more than the NLCS here. It feels like there's a player on the Phillies who has a multi-homer game each night here in October. So the home runs are really providing a lot of that momentum for Philadelphia, but also the pitching. And we're going to get into that here. But as we get rolling into this episode, we begin with the opener. And I think just a smooth segue is to focus on the teams who are in those 2-0 deficits right now, the Astros and the Diamondbacks. David, what should teams who are down 2-0 in a best of seven be thinking on that plane ride back to either their home city or the opponent's city?
Well, you kind of said it off the top. I mean, if you look at the things that are most important, and there's a lot of debate in terms of starting pitching. Yes, of course, starting pitching is very important. And you look at the top starting pitchers, both for Philly and the Rangers, they're the top four starting pitchers going right now. We'll get into that a little later. But home runs matter as well. The Phillies with 19 home runs so far is just bashing their way ahead in the home run differential. So you need to hit homers and you need to get good starting pitching. You know, it's as simple as that. That's how you can turn around a series. The ones that are in the hole 2-0, you look at the starting pitching matchups. And in Texas, you're looking at Max Scherzer with the Rangers, which is really, to me, the most interesting matchup to look at is what does Scherzer look like? And that's going to go a long way to tell, you know, what the Rangers are going to look like in terms of moving forward.
So we're going to see a little bit of a test of the depth of these rotations. The Phillies and Rangers have been the two best teams in the postseason, but Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler have made 6 of the 8 starts for Philly this postseason. For Texas, it's even more stark. Jordan Montgomery and Nathan Eovaldi have made 6 of the 7 starts for Texas. Now we're going to get into the depth portion. We've seen Ranger Suarez pitch very well for the Phillies. Now we're going to see Max Scherzer in game 3. He's a real question mark. What does he have in the tank against the Astros in the ALCS? But just getting back to the setting the tone with the starting pitching in game 3. Now, particularly with the Astros, because they're in a bit of a deeper hole having lost the 2 games at home compared to the Diamondbacks losing on the road. 28 MLB best of 7 series with the road team winning the first 2 games. Looking at those first 27, those teams are 24-3. There have only been 3 comebacks, and Coney, you were a big part of the last one. So of the 3 times that a team lost the first 2 games on the road and then came back to win a best of 7, the 1985 Cardinals in the World Series against the Royals, the 1986 Mets beating the Red Sox, Royals beat the Cards, Mets beat the Red Sox, and now the Yankees in 96 beating the Braves. And those 3 comebacks all started with a big game in game 3. Brett Saberhagen, complete game, 1 run. Bobby Ojeda, 7 innings, 1 run. David Cone, 6 innings, 1 run. So all it takes is one game to really turn the tide, like you alluded to, Coney. Mm-hmm. And so those are 3 big games. So I think there's going to be a lot on Christian Javier in Texas, on the road, hostile environment, to try and get the Astros back in the series.
You setting the scene there, I don't think anyone would be surprised if Christian Javier comes out and tosses a gem in game 3 against the Rangers in Arlington. I'm a little more focused, though, on the NLCS for game 3 in Arizona, because you talked about the Astros being in a hole after losing both games at home. The D-backs are in a hole. Yes, they're going back home, but they've also fired their 2 biggest bullets with Gallen and Merrill Kelly. And I know I've said it a bunch. I think you guys know me by now. I hate doing things for the first time in the postseason. But for game 3, and I got to give some love to the guys on Talking Baseball, because they said it right after game 2. What would you do if you're the D-backs for game 3? They had Brandon Fott starting in game 3, but these first inning home runs from the Phillies, it feels like they are crushing blows for the Diamondbacks. And I know Jake and Plouffe, they were saying that maybe they should employ an opener here. Maybe have Fott come in after that. Would that be a route you'd like to go? Maybe start this game off with a lefty reliever against this vaunted Phillies lineup. What do you think?
I think all bets are on the table. They should be. I mean, those are all great points in my mind. And yeah, that's where the Diamondbacks are. Beyond their top 2 starters, they're really thin, the rest of the rotation. So yes, to get creative in these types of situations, really important. Obviously, short hook on the starting pitcher if they do go traditional with Fott starting that game. So it'll be interesting to follow. But yes, if I'm in the Arizona Diamondbacks war room, I'm coming up with all sorts of different scenarios and options. And to potentially piece a game together, not only game three, but game four too, as well, until you can get back to the top of your rotation. You know, we may see that in game four as well.
Two options on the table like that. Even if you do trust Fought to give him a traditional start in game three, that's definitely going to be on the table for game four. We're not sure who would start game four. Would they even consider, here's another thing that you wouldn't do under normal circumstances, but do you bring back a short rest Zach Gallen? That's another option. But for game three, the Diamondbacks have a deeper pen than your typical team at this point. They've been really good in September and October. So maybe you can afford to do something like start an Andrew Salfrank as an opener, because he's not your one big lefty. You do have Mantiply back there for late in a late game scenario, but maybe you do start an Andrew Salfrank to try and get through a guy like Schwarber and Harper, and then hand the ball to Fought, give him a little bit of a cleaner landing there. Either way, these are all, they all have their pluses and minuses, and either way, you're going to be behind the eight ball against this Philly lineup the way they're rolling right now.
Yeah, if I were the D-backs, I wouldn't wait for game four. I would change my pitching plans for game three. I know Fouts pitched 19 games in the regular season. 18 of them were starts, but I would probably employ that lefty reliever to just try and halt that early momentum that we've been seeing from the Phillies throughout this postseason so far. They've scored at least one run in the first in each of the first two games. Try and neutralize that top third of the lineup. A few pitches scoreless first inning with those big bats right at the top, it's going to be different. And maybe we'll see something different happen. What could it lead to? Who knows? But I think you need to act with a little bit more urgency for game three. So I keep an eye on here and see if those game three starters, I know they have Fought slated in right now. I wonder if that'll change here ahead of game three coming up on Thursday over in Arizona. All right, Kona, you mentioned the top pitchers here in October. You alluded to a big four. And I think it's as easy as that, guys. There are four main pitchers who have really shined in October. You have Montgomery, Eovaldi, Nola, Wheeler. Ironic, right? Maybe not. The pitchers on the teams who are up 2-0 in their respective championship series. I'd like to know here and make your arguments, guys. Out of those four, who has been the best starting pitcher in the postseason?
Well, I got to look right at the top, you know, and I got a firsthand view of it, you know, covering the Philly series. And Zach, I mean, Wheeler's the guy. I mean, if you look at the stuff, he's just throwing rockets. And then his sweeper, breaking ball package is really good. Curveball, he's got three distinct different variations on his breaking ball package. So, yeah, 26 strikeouts, only one walk. You know, to me, that just jumps off the page at you. Eovaldi's right there too. Once again, Nathan Eovaldi, 24 strikeouts, only one walk. Those are kind of the two things you look at that just jump at you. They're striking guys out. They're not walking people. That is a formula for extreme success. And certainly Nola too, right along behind there, kind of a strikeout guy. Monty's not a big strikeout guy, but he's a big pitch guy. He makes big pitches when he has to. We talked about his curveball before when we covered him with the Yankees. When he needs to get a big swing and a miss, he can get one here and there, even though he only has 13 strikeouts, only two walks to go with it too as well. So, you know, Monty's a big pitch guy. He's a make a pitch guy. Wheeler's the stuff guy, you know, above and beyond upper 90s, couple different kinds of fastballs. His stuff has just been spot on. The only thing I worry about with the Phillies is, wow, that was Wheeler's. How many start already in the postseason? Three.
Mm-hmm.
How many more is he going to get?
Yeah.
If you go all the way, you know, that's the only thing I think about is terms of, you know, and speaking from experience, as the postseason progresses, all the emotion behind these big starts, the first one that he pitched, just dominant. Then he pitched another one, you know, to close out the series. Then you got to start off the next series, you know, I mean, he's already got three. It's sort of like each start that goes on, you wonder if it takes a little more out of you, how much stamina you're going to have. Be standing on the mound in a game seven, potentially. You know, is he the type of guy that they bring back on short rest, like a Jack Morris, pitch a game seven with everything on the line? Would that be seven extra starts? That's a tremendous bump on the end of your long regular season that you've got seven more starts in the postseason, potentially. Wheeler at three, I keep track of those because I know that they do, there's a tax, so to speak, to be paid at some point because these guys are going deep. They're pitching in big games. There's a lot of emotion.
And it with the expanded playoffs, that's one more round that you have to get through, one more big game that you have to post for. Now, I didn't think when you posed this question, Shaq, I did say, wow, I didn't think I'd be picking anyone other than Zach Wheeler. But Aaron Nola has been outstanding. And we talk about swing games. A lot of times it's a game three or a game four and like a best of seven. But he pitches seven shutout innings against the Marlins in the wild card series in the clincher. Get the sweep. You get the extra rest. You can line things up. NLDS, you take a big gut punch loss in game two in Atlanta. That series becomes a toss-up, 1-1 coming back home. He wasn't as great, but two runs, 5 2/3, nine strikeouts against that Braves lineup, swings the series to Philly. And then he comes through in game two against the Diamondbacks. A lot of run support, but six shutout innings, no walks, seven Ks. So Aaron Nola coming through all three starts with two runs or fewer, a 0.96 ERA, and 19 Ks against only two walks. So it's a little bit of an upset to me that it wouldn't even be a guy on his own staff, but Aaron Nola is my pick there.
Yeah, they've all been dominant. It's extreme nitpicking. Nola hasn't allowed any home runs. Evaldi and Wheeler have allowed two each, as I'm looking at their stats page right now, but they also have the higher strikeout numbers, like Coney said. So extreme nitpicking here. I'll go with Wheeler just because he's allowed the least amount of traffic on the base paths. Evaldi's given up 16 hits with those 24 Ks, that one walk. Wheeler has allowed seven fewer hits in just about the same amount of innings as well. Evaldi has 19 2/3. Wheeler has 19. Wheeler has allowed the least amount of traffic out of any of the pitchers that we're discussing here. So with the stuff and with that, I'm going to go with Zach Wheeler. David, you talked about something called postseason tax. I mean, are front offices looking at that for the next season, or are they worried about how the pitcher's holding up in the moment here in October?
Well, it's sort of twofold. You want to see how a pitcher reacts on the biggest of stages, obviously, and the pressure. And is this a guy who can lead your staff in postseason? So, yeah, there's only one way to prove that, and that's to actually do it. But on the other hand, it's a workload issue as well. And I've seen that where guys show up in spring training the next year. I know I felt it at times. It's like, wow, that's a short offseason. Your offseason, your whole offseason physical process changes. Give yourself a little extra rest possibly here and there. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you have to go through it to prove that you can do it. But on the other end, when you come out the back end in the next spring, it's sort of, is there a residual effect? And is there something physically that can carry over from one year to the next? You have to be really disciplined and be honest if you're a starting pitcher in terms of backing off your workload the following year. That's something that I wish I would have done a little more of back in the 90s when we were going to, you know, playoff series after playoff series, 4 out of 5 years, it was a pretty remarkable run. But I just know in some of those springs, I wish I would have taken a little extra time, you know, and managed my workload a little bit instead of the, you know, Monty Python's, you know, the Black Knight. I'm okay. It's only a flesh wound. I'll pitch again. Give me the ball. I'll throw 130 pitches. You know, that was the mentality back then. I wish I would have had a little more foresight to protect myself a little bit here and there.
Well, there was concerns about that this year with Aaron Nola and Christian Javier and some of these guys that did pitch deep into October last year. And now there was, you know, worries that, you know, some inflated ERAs, maybe shorter starts. And is there a bit of a postseason hangover? Maybe there is something like that, a residual effect with the Astros in general, because after a while you go into these deeper runs year after year after year. And Coney, you mentioned it with your time with the Yankees, where as a staff, that's, you're tacking on an extra month of high, high, high stress, high leverage pitching year after year. That is a residual effect, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I saw it happen firsthand, and it just, you know, I have all the utmost respect for these guys to keep going out there with their season on the line and pitch the way they do in big spots and push it a little bit too. These guys are pushing it into the sixth inning, three times through the batting order rather. And, it's kind of gets back to, you know, it's, it's back to what we always knew. You know, we know the teams that hit home runs have a better chance to win games. If you win that home run differential, and the Phillies are doing that. And then the teams that have good starting pitchers, number ones and number twos, that can, you know, the old saying, good pitching always beats good hitting. We're seeing that again. So kind of back to the future. Starting pitching is important again. And, you know, hitting the ball over the wall.
Yeah, I always remember reading about the pitchers on your teams in the 90s, Coney, about training for that extra month. You know, a guy like Andy Pettit, making sure he's, you know, he's training for, you know, 7 or 8 months while the rest of the league was training for those 6 months. So that's fresh in my mind when you bring that up there.
There's one reason why the Phillies are in such good shape right now is because they took the whole month of September to give their starting pitching extra rest along the way. They really mapped it out. And even without having, you know, clinched a wild card berth as of yet, they had a significant lead. And even though they had trailed the Braves for the entire year for the division, they kind of conceded that part. We're not going to catch the Braves, but we've got enough of a lead in the wild card where we could set our pitching up and give ourselves extra rest and have them on point. I think that's the best thing that we saw the Phillies do. It's paid big dividends for them. All I can tell you is that in 1999, Joe Torre and Mel Stottlemyre came to me in the month of September and said, "Hey, we want you to miss a start. We want to give you some extra rest." And I said, "How about just once a week? Pitch me, you know, every Thursday in the month of September." And we did. So I pitched once a week and had on the seventh day. So I had an extra 2 days rest, and that paid off for me in postseason to where I beat the Red Sox in the LCS in 99. And then beat the Braves again in the World Series. I didn't pitch in the first round, so they gave me extra rest in the first round too, the wild card round or the division series. But then the LCS, I pitched against the Red Sox with extra rest, and then the Braves again with extra rest. And believe me, it makes a big difference. And that's why the Phillies, I think, did the right thing, the smart thing with Rob Thompson, Dombrowski. They really lined up their pitching and had them well rested going into postseason.
More Tone the Slab is coming up. People, I need to tell you about a special offer from DraftKings because the NFL season is officially here. We've partnered with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official partner of the National Football League, to bring all new customers an exciting way to join in on the action right now. New customers, download the DraftKings app, use the promo code SLAB, S-L-A-B, bet just $5, and boom, $200 in bonus bets hit your account instantly. That's right, new customers who bet only $5 will get $200 in bonus bets instantly. Staying on the action, use your $200 in bonus bets on DraftKings parlays, combine multiple bets together for a shot at an even bigger payout. If sports betting is not yet available in your state, don't worry, you can still get in on the fun with DraftKings Daily Fantasy, where they offer cash prize contests for nearly every sport. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. New customers, use the promo code SLAB, again, S-L-A-B, bet just $5 on any wager and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's promo code SLAB only at DraftKings Sportsbook. So the spotlight is on these four pitchers that we're talking about: Eovaldi, Montgomery, Nola, Wheeler, and two of them are going to be hitting free agency here come the offseason. That's Aaron Nola and Jordan Montgomery, and that's kind of shined a spotlight on each of them with these big performances. Who would you invest more money in during free agency? Would it be Nola or Montgomery?
I think Nola's probably got a little longer track record. I'll defer to James Smythe, our wizard here, on piecing together factual information instead of just my opinion that I'm blowing right now. But Monty's probably made the most money, you know, as far as overall for himself. His stock has probably risen the most, but Aaron Nola probably has a little more of a track record as a swing and miss guy. That beautiful curveball he throws, his stuff is more prone to missing bats, I think. So he might get a little higher. He might get a little higher margin, you know, on the contract as far as that goes. But Montgomery's probably made the most money for himself of anybody out there.
Monty's had the bigger jump, I suppose. But Nola, I was a little wary of Nola this year because his peripherals jumped and there was a bit of concern about, well, is he transitioning into the league average innings eater portion of his career already before he even gets the big bite at the apple in free agency? Now, they're pretty much the same age. You might be surprised to see that Nola and Montgomery are both 30, and they're both, you know, they're a few months apart. Monty is actually a little bit older, surprisingly. And Nola, he is a guy who just answers the bell year in, year out. And I think that's what gives him the leg up still. And you don't want to overreact to three postseason starts, but he's starting from a bit of a higher level. And he's been one of the most valuable pitchers in the major leagues since 2017, 2018, however you want to draw the line. Now, here are his starts. Starting in 2018, his first All-Star year when he was third in the Cy Young voting. 33 starts, 34 starts, all 12 starts in the shortened 60-game season. 32, 32, 32. This guy takes the ball every fifth day, and he's showing that he is rounding into form at the right time, and he's having a big postseason. I think he is the number one free agent starting pitcher, at least stateside. We'll see if Yamamoto, he'll probably break the bank. But as far as the established big league pitchers here right now, I think Aaron Nola is going to end up getting the most out of anybody.
Yeah, as far as the domestic product, it's up between these two here. I'm actually going to go with Montgomery when you're comparing the two here. Both pitchers, yes, 30 years of age. Montgomery a little bit older, like you said, James. But Jordan has thrown almost exactly half the amount of innings in his big league career as Aaron Nola. Montgomery has 755 innings in the regular season as a big leaguer. Nola has just over 1,400 innings as a big leaguer in the regular season, not to mention these postseason games. So Nola, yes, is the workhorse that you've heard me say that I love and I covet, but I think Montgomery has a chance to maybe become that. So in my book, we pay for what we think a pitcher can be, not what they've done. In the long haul, both are going to command top dollar. Give me Montgomery in that situation.
You know, it's interesting. Some love for Montgomery here. Guys, we probably saw just about every single one of Jordan Montgomery's starts with the New York Yankees over many years. And he was a good pitcher. I liked him. I know you guys always had nice things to say about him. Solid pitcher, 3.94 ERA, which is a 109 ERA plus. He has gone to a different level with the Rangers. He didn't even crack St. Louis's postseason rotation last year. And now here he is coming over at the deadline to Texas. He has a 2.79 ERA to finish up the regular season in 11 starts. And now in the playoffs, 2.08 ERA, 13 Ks, 2 walks. He's been a rock for a somewhat questionable Rangers staff going into the postseason. Evaldi had his second half injuries. The bullpen was a complete mess. You didn't really know what you were going to get. Rotation, bullpen, Scherzer's injury. Evaldi and Montgomery really stabilized things.
Let's focus in more on this Rangers team. Go ahead, Coney. Sorry.
No, that's it. I was going to echo those sentiments. I agree. I think Monty's walk rate's come way down. That's the one area you look at. He's always been around league average in terms of his whiff rate or strikeout rate. His walk rate's kind of been cut in half. I think that's his secret sauce, is Monty's very confident throwing all his pitches for strikes now.
A lot less nibbling.
Yes.
So Montgomery's acquisition was like one of the final big moves that this Rangers team has done over the last two and a half years or so. Think about it. 2 years ago, this team lost over 100 games here. Now they are 2 wins away from the World Series, and they spent a lot of money, yes, but the bottom line is they're playing deep into October here. So this is an unconventional blueprint, right? We saw the Cubs, you see the Astros, we see teams try to do the tank method. The Rangers did the complete opposite. They spent a lot of money. What is preventing other ball clubs from following the Rangers' quick rebuilding model here?
Nothing should be stopping them, right? I mean, it's who you pick, and they picked very well. I mean, the guys in their peak, guys in their prime, and you can change your whole middle infield with one offseason. It was just remarkable between Seager and Semien, two very talented players up the middle. It's hard to change that whole dynamic. Look at the Yankees waiting on Volpe to get here. The stopgap with Kiner Falefa for a year. The Rangers went out and went, boom, here's a Hall of Fame left-handed batter. and Seager playing shortstop. And, oh, yeah, we're going to give him a partner and Semien to the right side. So you got to give them credit. The Rangers are dangerous because they have a big market with a new venue. They have revenue streams that are really popping now. They've never won a championship in their franchise history. They have high motivation. They have high revenue. They have tremendous resources. And you got to give Chris Young a lot of credit. This guy is really smart, ex-player, ex-Major League Baseball executive in their front office, have seen a lot of things, has done a lot of things, has that right combination of somebody who has actual Major League Baseball experience, somebody who has Major League Baseball executive experience, and then he comes in the perfect storm and is allowed to spend money and choose and pick who he wants. He deserves a lot of credit. Chris Young, one of the bright young minds and one of the bright young GMs in the game.
Sure thing. And you say, well, what's stopping teams from doing this? They're cheap. They're cheaping out, and pretty much any team could do this. A lot of people rolled their eyes when the Rangers made these moves because they had just lost 100 games. Why are you going out and getting Seager and Semien? Well, it's not just about the next year or the next year. It's that you build these guys. Hey, we just improved our middle infield by 8, 10, 12 wins in one fell swoop. And even if they're not there in 2022, maybe 2023, or maybe they're ahead of schedule, 2024. Point is that they got these guys to be cornerstones of the next good Rangers team, whenever that is. And when they spent in free agency, yes, they spent on Jacob DeGrom. That looks like a big miss right now, but they didn't put all their eggs in one basket. They didn't just say, hey, we got Jacob DeGrom and that's it. Nathan Eovaldi, other moves to augment their young core that's rising up, guys like Josh Young and Adolis Garcia, who continued his breakout. But the thing is too, that their payroll isn't really much higher than it was 10 years ago when they had the Josh Hamilton, Mike Napoli, Nelson Cruz teams with Ian Kinsler and stuff, when they won those back-to-back pennants. So it was really more about getting their payroll back to where it was, you know, several years ago. And there's room for them to grow. Kona, you mentioned the market they're in, the new ballpark, and winning begets winning, right? So they're packing their ballpark now, and that'll give them more resources to augment the team moving forward. But hats off to the Rangers. And same thing, this is a similar plan to what the Phillies have done, what Dave Dombrowski did coming into Philly. Big swings in free agency, not just Bryce Harper, but also Zach Wheeler, Nick Castellanos, JT Realmuto. So a lot of big hits in free agency.
Yeah, I think the Rangers were calculative in how they burnt that hole in their wallet. Right place, right time for a lot of these free agents. They are available at the right time, but they weren't gun shy. So that's, I think, the key right there. It can be done if you time it up correctly like they did, and you have to be bold and go for it. Take that leap. That's what the Rangers did, so credit to them. Some news happening around the league outside of the postseason. And one thing that happened on Monday down in Miami, Kim Eng left the Marlins. And we know that she walked away as the Marlins GM after the club reportedly tried to hire someone to serve above her. If that's true, not a good look for Miami at all. But let's focus on Kim Eng for her next move here. Is it apples to apples, guys? Or do you think Eng would go to a franchise that already has a president of baseball operations and place, and Eng could conceivably be that team's GM?
It'd be interesting to follow because she really proved herself, did a great job down there, even though it was a bit abbreviated and only 3 years. It just seems to me, you know, this is the way most front offices are run nowadays. And Kim Eng was hired by Derek Jeter. So she worked under Derek Jeter when he was there. When he left, there was nobody there to take his place. And that's what Sherman, the owner down there, is probably trying to do, is trying to replace Derek Jeter at the top of the hierarchy, similar to what the Mets did. Obviously, bringing in their new guy from Milwaukee. So, yeah, that's the way things are run nowadays. There's, the general manager is kind of more the executive, and there's somebody above him generally, or somebody above that position rather. So you kind of see this coming. I'm not sure what was going on down there, whether she thought she should have been the one who got bumped up, got a promotion, and she would be at the top of the hierarchy there. And then she could then in turn hire a general manager to help or bring somebody in that position. But this is nothing new. I think most of the people who followed the Marlins expected something like this to happen. The owner, Sherman, has been sort of, emphasizing his leadership more and more since Jeter left. And as I said before, that position that Jeter occupied was not filled. And it looked like that's what he wanted to do this time around. Whatever happened down there with Kim Ng, she didn't appreciate it. Or she felt like maybe now's the time for her to go somewhere else because there might be opportunities elsewhere. And there are. It's going to be an interesting follow because she's highly qualified and somebody who encompasses a lot of skills. And the work she did at the trade deadline for the Marlins got them in the playoffs. There's no two ways about it.
She got a long overdue opportunity in Miami. She made the most of it. This is one of the more moribund, least relevant franchises in the game over the last couple decades. And she built this team that, or at least put the finishing touches on a team that went to the playoffs in a full season for the first time since 2003. And maybe she should have been the one being kicked further upstairs then, because she earned the heck out of it. And now maybe onward and upward to bigger and better things with some team that isn't the Marlins. We'll see. Does she end up in Boston? That's an opening there. We'll see if she ends up in one of these other teams that might have a president of baseball operations already, but maybe it would be better to be in that role with some other team that isn't the Marlins, especially in Coney. You mentioned, you know, Bruce Sherman possibly asserting his position more vigorously. Sometimes that's a red flag as an owner.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of focused on in this story. Like Sherman, we've heard reports that he's heavily into, you know, the analytics, which isn't a bad thing, but it didn't seem like they were seeing eye to eye there. And like James said, the Marlins haven't had a ton of success for the last 20 years or so. She got them back to the postseason for the first time over a 162 game stretch. Doesn't hurt to try and have a little more faith and belief in that person who constructed that roster, made the necessary moves for that to actually happen, and kick her upstairs even further. We're all upstairs in these positions, right, Coney? But one thing that you mentioned, I kind of wanted to pump the brakes on here. Like, I have to imagine fans are wondering, when you have a GM and a Pobo in place, I mean, what is the purpose of the GM? Ultimately, you have the president of baseball operations calling the shots. So what exactly is a general manager doing in that structure?
Well, I think still the same executive work. Still, you know, beating the phone line, still, you know, presenting options on trades. I think you just have somebody above you that probably has a more uniform look at the entire organization, baseball operations, how they're run top to bottom all the way through the minor leagues. There's a lot of emphasis that's been put in recent years over – you know, a buy-in. Okay, are we going to build our analytics department? Are we going to buy in all the way down to the rookie ball hitting coach? You know, that's kind of the baseball ops guy to make sure that everybody's on the same page all the way up and down the organization, and then also have veto power on the major league roster as well. But there is a lot of executive duties that a general manager has to do and has to be aware of contractually, deadlines. It isn't just about picking and choosing which free agent you want or which trade you're going to make. There is a lot of duties for a general manager nowadays, and to have a little bit of help certainly is a good thing. I think the hierarchy is well established. You know, whether it's how the Dodgers are run is probably a good example of that in terms of the pecking order. It's understandable. Most organizations are run that way nowadays, and all the power nowadays, the big shift in the game has been power away from the managers, the game managers. Joe Torre used to make $5 to $7 million a year. Now the general managers or the guys that run baseball ops are making those kind of salaries. And the managers on the field are making the kind of salaries that the general managers used to make 10, 20 years ago. So that's really the shift. All the power's at the top now. The field managers and the general managers now have a lesser role in terms of what they used to have 20 years ago. And that's really indicative in what their salaries are. Look at who's making what, and that tells you where the power is.
There's a little bit of title inflation here too, right? Because if you're a team and you want someone's general manager and you want a general manager, you say, well, we're going to try and poach this person away and say, but we're giving them a promotion. We're able to get this guy and then make them president of baseball operations, as opposed to just general manager. So that kind of feeds on itself over the last, however, what is it, 10, 15 years. And now you say, all right, well, maybe there is, you know, maybe half or more than half of teams in baseball have this structure with a bit of a more of a pit stop between the general manager, team president, owner. So there's that extra person in there that's a cut above as the president of baseball operations. So it's a way to get people from other teams, like a David Stearns from Milwaukee to the Mets.
Good transition there, James. I'll tell you who has their work cut out for them this offseason. That's Matt Arnold of the Milwaukee Brewers. He's the GM of the Brewers. No Pobo in place after a year off with David Stearns. Obviously, he's onto the Mets, but Arnold's there now, and he has some adversity with his franchise. So Brandon Woodruff undergoing shoulder surgery. He's going to miss all of 2024. 2024 is also the walk year for Woodruff, really unfortunate timing for him, but also for Corbin Burns, for Willy Adames on the positional side. Freddie Peralta has a couple of team options, but his contract is technically also up as well. Are the Brewers the team with the most to figure out this offseason after this Woodruff injury?
Yes, and it starts right at the top with their manager. Craig Counsell is the guy that everybody loves, the guy that has, if you are going to do a fantasy draft of Major League Baseball managers, he might be the number one pick. I mean, that's how highly he's thought of. That's how well he's done his duties in Milwaukee. And nobody knows what he really wants to do. He lives up there in Wisconsin. He's got kids in school up there. He's a local guy. Does he want to stay? Their contract negotiations kind of didn't go anywhere in terms of an extension. And so now he's sitting there. And that's the real thing. He's that good. And that's the big decision for the Brewers. Can they bring him back? Is it possible? Does he want to come back? And until that is decided, you know, they don't know which direction to go, because a manager and Counsell is that important to that franchise, that team. He's the guy that got the buy-in all the way around. He understands analytics. He understands the baseball side of things. He's the perfect conduit, you know, to blend the two together. And I think it's more important than ever. When you hear things like Aaron Judge saying, maybe we're looking at the wrong numbers, or questioning, you know, how the information is being delivered. To me, it's kind of that last mile guy that's become so important in baseball. Somebody who can interpret the data and then get it to the players in a language that they can understand. And that's never been more important. It's not about whether the information is right or wrong, or whether you're too analytical. The boogeyman, right, James? We talk about this all the time. Oh, the Yankees are too analytical, or baseball's too analytical. Analytics is ruining the game. No, no, it's not. The question is that last mile guy. What are you doing with all this good information, and how are you translating it, and who's delivering that message to the players, and are they buying it? Are they getting it from the right source? I think that's the question. That's what Counsell does better than anybody. That part right there is what he does better than anybody, and that's why he's become so valuable. And until you figure out what he's going to do, the Brewers don't know which way they're going.
They are the team that's probably the most in flux out of contenders, recent contenders. And the thing they have in their corner is that it's the National League Central, so it's not like someone's going to run away and hide. You know, we'll see what the Cubs do in free agency this year. Do they bring back Cody Bellinger? The Cardinals could be reloading. The Reds, are they ascendant? They kind of faded down the stretch, but they have some good young players. So it's a little bit of a toss-up with the Brewers there in the NL Central, but a lot of questions, a lot of question marks. And as Coney eloquently pointed out, it really starts at the top with Craig Counsell.
So you guys think if Craig Counsell's decision to return or not return could be the difference between the Brewers saying, hey, let's strip this down. We have too many guys in their free agent years. We just lost our manager, who is the guy that holds the glue for a ball club when it comes to information. We're going to be dealing with another step back already. Let's strip it down, see what we could get for guys like Burns and Adames and Peralta.
I could totally see that.
They've been really smart about when to pull the plug too. Even if it did cause some clubhouse turmoil, and all you had to do is go back to the Hader trade, Josh Hader to the Padres last year, and that really shook up their clubhouse. And I think just from reading the tea leaves, and in terms of culturally speaking in a clubhouse, it was probably a misread on their part. Just from a executive contractual standpoint, it probably wasn't. Probably was more of the right time to do that, depending on who they got back in return for that trade and how that works out long term. But that, once again, that comes into the sort of the finesse part of the game. And, you know, the players, the old school mentality, and then the new school mentality of, you know, information, timing, when to make trades, who to bring in, who fits in a clubhouse. I mean, I think clubhouse culture has never been talked about more or been more important than nowadays. And all you have to do is look at the Yankee clubhouse this year and as an example of that.
Now, Craig Counsell theoretically could hold all the cards for this entire offseason throughout this sport, because if he doesn't, if he decides not to return, the Brewers explore potentially trading a guy like Corbin Burnes. I don't know. I have to look a little bit further into this, a little dig it a little deeper, but maybe I'm more enticed to trade for a Corbin Burnes versus signing an Aaron Nola or a Jordan Montgomery, acquire Burnes, lock him up to a long-term deal. This could turn the offseason on its head, everything happening up in Milwaukee for sure. Let's talk about the Yankees, fellas. Pretty quiet in Yankee land, which means a massive piece of news is probably going to be breaking right as we release this episode. But our awesome producer here, Dan Rourke, over at Yankees Avenue, and check out his channel if you haven't already, because he is one of the more passionate and real Yankee fans that you're going to find. He gave his offseason blueprint. Dan, how many years have you been giving the Yankees offseason advice now?
About 3 years now, although the first one, I did not factor budget in at all. I believe I asked them to sign pretty much every free agent that was on the market. But since last year, I started really like kind of go into it with the budget in mind and like from a realistic point of view. So I'd say going on 2 years now has been the legit blueprint.
Okay. So are you keeping tally? Are you holding receipts on what they listen to and what they
do? Oh, they don't ever listen to me. No, they have yet to listen to me on anything besides, I think re-signing Aaron Judge was the only thing I got correct last year. But in this year's edition, I went in a little bit in the middle of both want and prediction. So it was kind of like a combination of both. So maybe I'll be a little more accurate this time around.
All right. So again, we encourage you to go check that out on Yankees Avenue on YouTube. But let's give the listeners the Cliff Notes version here of Dan Rourke's offseason Yankees rebuild, the blueprint there. Number one, acquire Brandon Donovan from St. Louis. And Dan says you do that in exchange for two pitchers, Clark Schmidt, Johnny Brito. Sign Yoshinobu Yamamoto, the Japanese pitcher, 7 years, $189 million. Next up on the list, sign Kevin Kiermaier, veteran center fielder, 2 years for $16 million. Item number four is trade Gleyber Torres. Now, Dan says that is not what he wants, but it's just his prediction here because it'll free up $15 million in payroll. And you could either grab some prospects or major league ready pieces in return for Gleyber, who has a year left before he hits free agency. And item number five, acquire Juan Soto from the Padres for a handful of prospects led by pitcher Drew Thorpe, Everson Pereira, Oswald Peraza as well. He also said he would lean toward giving away Spencer Jones if it is absolutely necessary. Now, we're going to be nitpicking here, guys, because that's how highly we think of Dan Rourke's GM ability. So how would you grade Dan Rourke's GM skills with this offseason blueprint?
It's a nice wish list. It really is. I think the couple of problems stand out in terms of, is Brendan Donovan even available with the card? I think they might push Dylan Carlson more. I think they probably want to keep Brendan Donovan, but yeah, you got to find out. So, but I'm doubtful that can be pulled off. Soto too, Juan Soto. I'd love him. Obviously, he's a perfect fit. Yankees would love to have him. Is he available? I'm just not so sure. The way the Padres have done business, I'm not sure they're ready to pull the plug on him yet. It's unknown. And plus, if you just wait one more year, you can sign him just for money as a free agent, as opposed to gutting out your prospects to get him for an extra year. He's that good, though, so you'd probably do it if he's available. That's the question, if he's available. Now, trading Gleyber Torres, that's such a popular notion, right? I mean, everybody's been talking about that for a while. You're talking about a team that was last in the league in batting average. He's the one guy outside of Judge that can hit. And so if you're going to lose him, you better replace that offense somewhere. This is a guy who hit 25 home runs, had a 118 OPS plus. He was almost 20%, a little shy of 20% above league average as far as second baseman and offensive production. Top five guy across pick a category, any combination of stats. And he's in the top five offensively across the board. So if you're going to subtract Gleyber Torres from this Yankee offense that really struggled to score runs last year, you better be careful. You better replace that production or even more, because that's the problem. You need offense, and you're losing your second best offensive guy, even though he is going to be a free agent after next year. the Yankees never worried about that stuff. You know, they don't worry about trying to preempt and sign contracts. And then the times they have done it, it hasn't worked out. Sort of Aaron Hicks style contract has never worked out for the Yankees. So, I see it. If everything falls together and you can get Brendan Donovan, you can add Juan Soto, then yeah, you can trade Gleyber Torres. Then at that point, if you replace the offense with Soto and Donovan, but I'm not sure those two guys are available, but I love the players. I love the idea. The Yamamoto is going to be a frenzy, by the way. So who knows where he ends up?
Well, that's the tricky thing with trades, right? You don't know how your prospects are going to match up with this team. Do they like your prospects more than you think? Do they like them less? So it's a tougher needle to thread. That said, I love the Yamamoto idea. I think he is the best free agent pitcher, and he's probably the best free agent player, hitter or pitcher, available. And it probably is going to be a frenzy, Coney. All you can do is make the biggest offer. If he wants to take less money to go elsewhere, good luck to you. See you down the road. I like the Kiermaier idea. It's more of a veteran stopgap. Donovan, we talked about Donovan, was it last week or the week before? And you mentioned his on base, his versatility, great fit. But is he going to be available, like Coney said? Soto, I would be more inclined to wait a year because it doesn't seem like Soto would be inclined to get traded somewhere and then sign an extension without hitting free agency and taking that big swing. That said, it's another thing where the Padres, they traded for Juan Soto to try to make a run for three Octobers. Year one was a big success with the NLCS trip. This past year was a mess, not so much because of Soto, but there was a lot of other things going on. Do they say, hey, we're going to take one more crack at this before we really want to tear it down? Now, what would be is this a reasonable deal? I'm terrible at this kind of stuff. With this, you know, is this trade package worth it? Now, I think the big comp for a potential Soto trade is Mookie Betts. And Mookie Betts was traded for Alex Verdugo, who had gotten his feet wet in the major leagues. And Jeter Downs, who is a fringy top 100 guy, and Connor Wong, who was kind of the throw in there. And he's actually shown that he could maybe be a big league catcher. That said, looking at this, I mean, Drew Thorpe, Everson Pereira, Oswald Peraza, these guys are all on the Baseball America top 100, and Spencer Jones is a possibility too. So I feel like that is a reasonable, level-headed offer. This isn't one of those, WFA and, you know, Michael K show, some crank calls up.
I was worried
says,
about
yeah,
that, James.
Oh yeah. Give him Jobber Chamberlain for Barry Bonds. You know, no, it was nothing like that.
Here's what I'll say. Let's start off with what I love. Sign me up for $189 million for Yamamoto because I think it's going to be higher. I think he's going to crack $200 million. So I'm on board with that. I'm on board with Kevin Kiermaier. I wouldn't go past 2 years with Kevin Kiermaier. If some team is actually going to be able to offer him three, I wouldn't swim in those waters either. The Yankees are one offseason removed from David highlighting the fact that they really emptied their pitching depth at the highest levels of their minor league system with some trades over recent seasons. So you're doing that even further by dealing away Clark Schmidt, Johnny Brito, and Drew Thorpe in some of these trades. Yes, they need offense, but we saw what happened when you lack pitching depth. And there are a ton of question marks, even if you add Yamamoto in this rotation. So I'd be wary to part with two pitchers for a guy like Brendan Donovan. I'd get a little more creative and try to see what I could do to get a piece like Brendan Donovan. And for Juan Soto, as much as I would like, that is part of me saying, do it. You know, everyone's a suspect. And what's the old saying about prospects?
Prospects are suspects.
Yeah, prospects are suspects. Do it here. It's a chance to, again, leave no doubt in the peak of the prime with Aaron Judge, Gerrit Cole, get an electric performer in Juan Soto. Another part of me is saying, hey, it'll only cost money in a year. Go after them then if you're really interested. So I'm on the fence there with trading Juan Soto. We have to see if he's available. And I'm also on the fence with Gleyber Torres. Like David said, behind Aaron Judge, he was the most productive, most consistent hitter for the Yankees this season. Now, what can you bring in that would make you feel better about parting with Gleyber Torres? Is a Soto and a Donovan on the table? If you could bring them in, yeah, then I'd feel more comfortable about trading Gleyber Torres. But what is that? Two that I'm in favor of and three that I'm, you know, either on the fence or against. So Dan Rourke, I'm giving you like a 5.5 here, 6. I know I'm a hard grader, but you're giving away too much pitching depth, man.
No, I respect it for sure. And on the topic of trading Gleyber, that's, once again, not something I would want to do by any means. It's more so just, one, it fell into having to make room budget-wise for Soto because he's projected to make around like $33 million this year. So to fit him into like my plans financially, I had to get rid of his $15 that Gleyber's going to make. And once again, getting rid of Gleyber, I only would do that with also getting in like Gleyber out, Donovan and Soto in. Of course, if you're just losing Gleyber, that's horrible. The Yankees offense was bad with judging Gleyber last year. You don't want to, you know, subtract your second best hitter for nothing. But yeah, as for Donovan, I mean, I've kind of, like I said it last week, I've kind of fallen in love with the guy over the past, you know, 2 weeks of doing research. I hear you on the Cardinals may not be willing to give him up. I do believe, though, that there is going to be some sort of a trade. And if there was with the Cardinals, he's the guy I would go after the hardest, just because the things I mentioned, 12th highest OBP in baseball since 2022, plays all over the place. James, you mentioned last week how he won the Gold Glove for utility players, which are also all things why, like, why would the Cardinals want to trade this guy? I understand that, but I also think their need for pitching and sending back Clark Schmidt, who has 5 years of control left, Johnny Brito, or to be honest, I actually had the initial deal being Clark Schmidt and Nestor Cortez, and I realized that was probably a massive overpay and pretty dumb to do, so I scaled that back to Clark and Johnny Brito. But if there's a realistic way to get that deal done, that's something I would want to do. On the topic of Soto, though, here's the way I see it. If you don't go out and get Soto, you pivot to Cody Bellinger, which I think is the most realistic thing. The Yankees need to put fans back in the seats. They got to, you know, get hype back surrounding this team. And I think they're going to make some sort of a big splash or two, one being Yamamoto, the other being probably Cody Bellinger. But the way I see it is this. If you don't get Soto now, you settle for Bellinger. Signing Bellinger probably takes you out of the running for Soto next year. So it's kind of a thing where you got to like look yourself in the mirror and be like, okay, do we want this guy or not? And when you're seeing Bryce Harper go off in the playoffs, Corey Seager doing the things that he's doing, these are guys that you could have had. Like, how long are we going to go without the true 1A to Aaron Judge? And Cody Bellinger is nice. You know, he had a great year. I can buy into the fact that he's finally healthy. Those last 2 years with Dodgers had the shoulder injury that was apparently greatly mishandled. That's why he struggled. All right, bounce back this year. Great. But, I mean, he might be headed for a contract worth over $200 million. And when you look at some of the peripherals that he's putting up this year, I'm not so sure I buy into him being that sort of a player. So it kind of just scares me that, okay, if you settle for Bellinger, that's good. And I would get excited about that. But if that's the case, you probably don't go out and get Soto next year. So I understand, you know, trading all these prospects for just 1 year, and who knows if that would even, yeah, like, you don't know if the Padres are even willing to give him up. But with all that said, I think you should try your absolute hardest to find it if they are. Like, you at least make the phone call, you have the discussion, because they're trying to get their payroll apparently to below or right around $200 million, and they're at like 250 right now. I mean, they're losing Hader and Snell in free agency, so that'll help. Most likely, not losing them, but they might. But I think it's on the table enough to where you have the phone call, you have the discussion with AJ Preller. And if there's a package that can get it done that doesn't involve, like, honestly, Jason Dominguez is my only real untouchable right now. Besides that, yo, I would include Spencer Jones. I probably would include Drew Thorpe or even like a Chase Hampton, who's above Thorpe in the prospect rankings. So I know a lot of this comes from just me being like Yankee fan, want to, you know, put the best team out there.
No, Dan, stop right there, man. I mean, you gave a terrific rebuttal in this faux Yankees boardroom that we have right here. You pounded your fist on the table. You explained yourself. And I tell you what, you kind of made me a believer of your last move. If when you put Soto next to Bellinger and you weigh those possibilities and you put out the timeline like you did, yeah, I think you're making me a believer in this Soto trade. So yeah, stop right there with, you know, take the fandom out of it, my friend. I think you're on your way.
Yeah, and also, what was my next point going to be? Also, going back to similar to what you said with the Rangers, James, how they signed Seager, they signed Semien. It's not all about just, you know, 2023. That's not what I'm focused on here. But the way I see it is you get Donovan, you get Yamamoto, and then you get Soto, let's say, on a very big ass. You, of course, do have to try your best to extend him, or, you know, I assume they would get him in free agency if he decided not to take an extension. But anyways, that's basically is reestablishing a window, because Donovan in control, 5 years. Yamamoto you'd have for 6 or 7 years. And then Soto, if you get a deal done, that's probably 10 or so. So very quickly with these offseason moves, just in terms of like why I'd want them to happen for obvious reasons, is because very quickly then you got a window again of, all right, kind of like whether it works out this year or next year, a few years from now, like championship caliber window, in my opinion, would be reestablished. I do hear you guys though on the return of some of these things that, like, you know, giving up pitching would be tough, especially after we like totally fleeted our farm system out at the 2022 deadline. And maybe the Cardinals would want more than just Clark or Brito, but yeah, man, that's kind of just where I'm at.
Salient points. Yankees, most of your heavy lifting this offseason has been done for you by Dan Work. So, you know, act accordingly.
Thanks for letting me do this, by the way, guys. I was, when I saw the message, that you were going to have me go over this, I was like, yo, word? Heck yeah. David Cone's going to listen to my offseason blueprint? All right.
I like it. I like it. Good names. All good names.
Thanks, guys.
All right. We'll see how much the Yankees are listening to Dan Work here with his offseason blueprint. We appreciate you, Dan. And again, go check it over at yankeesavenue.com for his full assessment, his full list of items for this Yankees offseason. Gentlemen, like we said, two teams halfway to winning the pennant. What are you going to be looking out for really quick as we wrap up this episode?
Yeah, I think obviously to me, seeing how Max Scherzer throws the ball is huge for the Rangers, for really their chances of moving forward. You know, that's the story right now. So I'm watching Max Scherzer, how deep he can go, what his stuff looks like, and does it look like he can help them? And then obviously the Phillies are a juggernaut right now. I don't know how you stop them. I mean, they're feeling so good about themselves. Everybody's clicking. Schwarber's now on board. The way they're pounding offensively, the way they're built for this. I think if Dave Dombrowski wasn't already a Hall of Fame candidate as a general manager, I think if they close this one out and finish this one off, that puts him right there to me on the brink of, you know what, this guy's got a Hall of Fame career going. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times everywhere he's been, there's been criticism. Oh, he just sells the farm system and he just buys the best players. And you know what? He's more than that. And he's proved it. And he can put together a roster. And he can put together the hitters first in a sport that lacks bats. He went bats first, whether it's Castellanos or even back, even going back to Harper. I think, you know, Philly in general, let's get the bats first. And then, you know what, we'll find a defensive center fielder in Rojas. We'll find some better defenders, but let's put the bats together, score runs, let's bash. And then we'll build around the edges there and then fix what needs to be fixed. And it's exactly what they've done. I think they deserve a lot of credit. I think Dombrowski deserves a lot of credit. One of the best executives of his generation, in my mind, especially if they close this deal.
I think he's already Cooperstown bound, but this is a little cherry on top. And I think that the Phillies will be popping champagne in the pool. I don't think that NLCS is going to get back to Philly over in the AL. Like we said at the top, you know, the Astros are still the team to beat until someone beats them four times in seven games. Well, the Rangers are halfway there. Scherzer, a big question mark for game three. We'll see what he has. And for Texas, if you can just win two out of three in your building, you can win the pennant and keep that series from going back to Houston, because that's something you don't want. You don't want to wake the Giant. You don't want the Astros to get a little blip of life in this ALCS.
Hate to be boring. I'm looking at the same stuff. The question mark of Scherzer could potentially provide the opening that a team like the Astros can need and use to get back into this series. And for the NLCS, I'll shout it from the mountains here. And again, I don't like trying new things in the postseason, but Diamondbacks, use an opener for game three. Brandon Faulk, come in after that. Try and do something different to neutralize the top of that Phillies lineup at the start of game three. That's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel so you don't miss the latest clips and full episodes that we're doling out each and every week. We're going to come back if something big happens here, obviously before the World Series, so potentially sprinkle in a couple of bonus episodes for the rest of the way along the 2023 season. That's going to do it for this episode. For James, for David, for our great producer, Dan Work, I'm Justin Shackle. We'll talk to you next week on Tone the Slab, and probably before that, Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, a production of John Boy Media. Take care, everybody.